I will sing. Well, I've been doing a lot of these sermons through the years, and every year you give me a different and intriguing topic, and this year was class and economics in the early Mass Bay, and I grabbed it. I wanted to do this sermon. I've wanted to do it for a long time. I begin with a story about Boston in the 1920s. A Chicago banking house wrote to Lee Higginson and Company because they wanted a letter of recommendation for a young Bostonian. Well, Lee and Higginson wrote back saying they could not say enough positive things about this young man. His father had been a Cabot, his mother a Lowell, and there was a happy blend of Saltonstalls and Appletons, Peabodys, and other first families mixed in. Days later came a curt acknowledgement. Lee Higginson and Company were thanked for their trouble, but the letter from Chicago read that that was not the material upon the young man that they sought. It said, we were not contemplating using him for breeding purposes. So class has always been an issue, a live issue, in the active common life of Boston. It's inescapable. And it's inescapable because the Puritans, as Neil so rightly said, help make America what it is. So that's part of what I'll be talking about today. Now, David Hackett Fisher, in his marvelous book of sociology, Albion Seed, and I really recommend it, he said that there are about 25 folk ways in which you identify a people and how they operate and how they function. And class is a notoriously difficult thing to talk about because it's not, strictly speaking, how much money you have. You know, I can be a poor minister, and I'm still a classy guy. And there can be nouveau rich who are not classy at all. So class is a slippery concept. But if you take Fisher's folkways, and you include what he calls wealth ways, rank ways, social ways, order ways, power ways, if you put the five together, you've made some progress to understanding what you're really talking about when you talk about class. And so who were the Puritans who helped make us who we are that we're looking at in terms of Charter Day, the celebration of the founding of the Mass Bay? Well, they were dissenters. And they were largely, sociologically speaking, a middling yeoman class, largely from centered in East Anglia. And there were very few aristocrats among them, some, but not many. And there were very few poor among them. Only 5% of them were listed as laborers. That was astonishingly small in terms of the migration to the New World. Thomas Dudley, who helped found us as a congregation, said that the people that would come should be, quote, furnished with means. But you can't really define the Puritans sociologically because it's what they believed that made them who they were. And they brought together a set of radical beliefs that upended English society and sent waves of citizens across the great ocean to help found a new nation. They were radical. And they believed, first of all, in human depravity. Puritans were fun. There's no getting around it. They believed in human depravity to such an extent that one historian says, these are people that it would be impossible to downcast. They believed in grace, God's grace, and that it might come your way, but you never deserve it, ever. That's why they call it grace. And they believed in election, that there would be a few chosen through this grace. They called it limited atonement. Limited atonement. And so this inexplicable gift of being anointed, chosen by God, came to you, and it was described as unconditional, irresistible, and inexorable. So how to solve this troubling mystery of who is saved? Well, they wondered about that. And so they went, and they looked around, and they thought, oh, we're poised on a bit of a theological dilemma here. If God is omnipotent, all-knowing, and omnipresent, knowing the future as well as the past, you know where that leads you? Before you were born, God has already judged you and offered, maybe, that limited atonement. But there would be nothing you could do to earn it. It is an inexplicable gift. But yet it mattered, it bugged them deep in the recesses of their hearts, waking up at 3 a.m. in the Puritan soul. Am I saved? How can I know? How can I know if, perhaps more importantly, if my neighbor is saved? Because as I look over there, he's got more gables than I've got. Personal conversion experiences, being witnessed by the community, that was a big help. But it was not enough because of that sneaky condition of depravity. It was really hard to outguess. And because the Puritans were just human beings, they did what human beings across the board and probably in every time and every place have done. They assessed those around them who were most evidently successful as probably, likely, people that God had favored, had always favored, and would likely in the future favor. Now, don't get me wrong. These hardy settlers did not worship money or success. Compared to the other colonies, the divide between the poor and the wealthy was fairly narrow. They were even a little bit uneasy in the early days about evident wealth. But they valued work big time, and they valued most of all the effective use of God's time given to each of us. They would not even take Christmas Day off. You just worked. And they drove themselves continuously to generation upon generation of accumulated wealth and status. That's just what happened. An English visitor disapproved of their leveling prospects. He didn't like, quote, that everybody had property and everybody knows it. Still, there was no getting around the tendency. Winthrop said on the Arbella, the God had made, quote, some poor, some high and eminent in power and dignity, and others mean and in subjugation. And I think you know who you are. Harvard students early on were ranked by social order of their families, as often was the assignment of pews in meeting houses. John Cotton believed in social hierarchy. He said, I do not conceive that ever God did ordain democracy as a fit government either for church or commonwealth. And yet that democracy came anyway, and they are largely responsible for it. But it kind of came almost accidentally, this soul liberty. It was part and parcel of their deep theology, but it kind of happened almost in spite of them. And Max Weber, a sociologist in the 1920s, said, if you want to understand capitalism, you have to go to the very heart of Calvinist Protestantism. In other words, us. And there you will find where capitalism actually begins. And there you can see the trick here, and why it goes deeply into theology, and theology that matters today. One observer of the Puritan said, convinced that character is all, he sees in the poverty of those who fall by the way not a misfortune to be pitied and relieved, but a moral failing to be condemned, and enriches not an object of suspicion, though like other gifts that may be abused, but in the blessing which rewards the triumph of energy and will, tempered by self-examination, self-discipline, self-control. The victories are won not in the cloister, but on the battlefield of life, in the counting house, and in the marketplace. Now, you probably have heard something called prosperity gospel. You didn't hear it here, but you probably heard about it. And I cannot pin, and I won't pin, this theological travesty on John Winthrop. But if you take this overarching view of how human beings often, almost in spite of themselves, use their theology and their wonderment about who's anointed, who's saved, who is in God's good grasp, we have often confused class and worldly success in that assessment. It's hard to escape the influence that this wealth theology has even on religion today in America. A Time magazine poll said that 31% of Americans espouse the idea that if you will give your money to God, God will bless you with more money. So we're actually going to be doing the passing the plate again. But 61% agreed with the idea that, quote, God wants people to be prosperous. Protestant Calvinists, who believed in that predestination, the idea that God has chosen certain people, always, felt the need to justify their own sense of themselves as the saved. Baptist preacher Russell Conwell said, I say you ought to be rich and you have no right to be poor. 4 in 10 evangelicals in America preach the prosperity gospel today. And you may think, oh, poor benighted people. But no, 19 million people were influenced by Oprah to buy the book The Secret about 10 years ago. If you think really positively, you will get rich. People think, God's strength is mine, God's health is mine, I am a winner, I'm a conqueror, I am blessed. As Joel Osteen, the pastor of America's largest church, told Oprah in his Texas mansion, Jesus died that we may live an abundant life. And you may think, well, this is all very interesting, Stephen, but what does it really have to do with the common life of America? And do you think that we would be treating healthcare the way we treat it in America if we did not have a fundamental, hidden, subterranean belief that people deserve their illness? That the unlucky are somehow responsible for their misfortune? That what we're living through, this time of fear and suspicion, is a cultural reward for all those who have drowned out the simple evocation of Jesus that the last shall be first. That the divine favor is actually devoted to the poor. That that's where God's solidarity is and always was. And all this matters. It isn't just academic. It says so much about the age in which we find ourselves. The average American believes wrongly that we are a classless society, that we are a nation where social mobility is open and easy, and it's not, and it's getting worse. We're descending into another gilded age of radical inequality, and mostly religious authority sits by and says and does nothing, and a significant proportion actually blesses that inequality as suitable for God's judgment. Well, you know what? The upper 10% of Americans have had their income double since 1980. Top 1% has had their income triple. And the 0.0001 has increased 700%. And in that same time period, do you know what the bottom half has increased? $200 since 1980. This is a golden age on steroids. When Jesus began his ministry, he quoted Isaiah 61. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord has appointed me and anointed me to bring good news to the poor. That's seeing the word anointed in the truer way. Jesus talked 3 times as much about wealth and money as he ever did about prayer. To bring good news to those who do not benefit, for those who struggle and strive to live lives of even bare equality. All this matters. It has always mattered. And it is a profoundly religious task for us to speak the truth and to live the truth. Needless to say, I end by saying we need to recover that leveling quality of our forebears, that quality of the Mass Bay migration that was open, not always true to, but open to the idea that there should not be sharp differentials between the rich and the poor, and that worldly success was to be admired but not seen as God's blessing. Blessed are the poor was an invitation for us all to live a new life, not permission for the continuation of the poor. To bring good news, to bring good news again this Charter Day, let us be mindful, cautioned by the past as much as we are inspired by it. History is a daunting mirror. It is never just a celebration. In the covenant of this congregation are the ancient words that for me still function as an invitation as well as an admonition to walk together in all our ways. Amen. And now this morning's offering for the care and sustenance of this community of faith.